This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in African American Studies podcast on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ari Barbalat. I am honored to be in conversation today with my distinguished guest, Professor Chris Henning. Chris Henning is the Bloom Professor of Law and Director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative at Georgetown University Law School. We are here today to discuss her new book, The Rage of Innocence: How America Criminalizes Black Youth, published in New York by Pantheon Books 2021. Chris, it's my humble honor to be in dialogue with you today.
I feel the same way. Thank you so much for having me, Ari.
Thank you. It's a blessing to be in dialogue with you and to have read your book. And I just wanted to thank you for everything that you invested in it in light of personal sacrifice and in regard to the time, investment, research, and personal endeavor that went into this.
Thank you so much. I care passionately about the topic, so the investment came naturally.
Absolutely, as do I. That's why I'm so lucky to be in touch with you today. To begin, please tell us about yourself. Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life inspired you to become a lawyer and a scholar?
So I am originally from the South, I say, the southern part of the United States. I was born in Nashville, Tennessee, and then lived in what I call my formative years in North Carolina, and in a relatively small town in North Carolina at that. And so that in and of itself, you know, means that I am a Black American raised in the South, which is in and of itself a defining demographic criteria. But I grew up with parents who cared deeply about social justice issues, and they also cared about young people. My mother was a professor of early childhood education, and my father, although he was a businessman, a sort of traditional business person in management, he also cared about young people and would engage with young people at our local church, for example, hosting a Friday night group with young boys in the neighborhood. And so I think I always grew up thinking about people who were, economically less fortunate than I was, thinking about political causes that were important around racial equity. And my parents cared a lot about schooling and educating their children. So I think for me, that's really sort of formative and led me in many ways to law school, and then ultimately to a focus on representing children as a lawyer.
What inspired you to write this book?
So I have been representing children accused of delinquency in Washington, D.C. for the last 26 years. And in that entire time, I have only represented 4 white children, which is just an absolutely absurd statistic. It would lead you to believe either that there are no white children in Washington, D.C., or that white children don't commit crime. And so I really wanted to write this book to reflect on, just the reasons why we have such extreme racial disparities in our country. And I also wanted to know, and this is, I think, the most important thing, I wanted to know, why or how those racial disparities and this deep criminalization of Black children is what I talk about in the book, how it was impacting Black children developmentally, mentally, emotionally, physically even. And so that's what this book really explores.
What message do you hope your readers will glean from this book?
I hope everyone walks away recognizing and really remembering that Black children are children too. Really, that is the ultimate message. And that when we think about how we respond to normal adolescent behaviors among children of color, we need to treat them, Black children, as if they were any other child. And so I hope that readers will see themselves in this book, read some of the stories that I write about young children that I represented, high profile examples of other children that that we've heard about in the news. I want the readers to see themselves in these stories and say, I did that when I was a kid, or my own child did that and we didn't get arrested. And I hope that's a way that readers will become invested in making a difference.
Where do you situate this book among current writing and research on this topic? How do you distinguish your contribution from the contributions that other scholars and journalists have made and are making to this topic?
Yeah, so that's a great question. There are a lot of wonderful, insightful books about the criminal legal system in our country, and some books about policing that have been great, that speak specifically, I think, to criminal justice issues writ large. Locking Up Our Own by James Foreman, The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, Chokehold by Paul Butler, Policing the Black Man, which is an anthology edited by Angela Davis. But my book enters this space with a focus on the policing of adolescence, right? And the policing of Black children in particular. And I think that requires a special telling. And when I talk about policing of adolescence, I'm not just talking about police officers in a blue uniform, but I'm talking about all of us, right? All of us as civilians, who walk through a park, walk through city streets and find ourselves afraid of Black children. And so we need to be thoughtful about how we're all policing by proxy. And so I think this book adds to the body of literature that is there by focusing on specifically the criminalization of normal adolescent behaviors, as one broad theme. Another broad theme is the hyper surveillance and aggressive policing of Black children. And then the third, you know, theme that I think I add to the discourse is the unique ways in which Black children are dehumanized, even when they engage in, you know, real criminal behavior, not that normal adolescent behavior that we have decided to criminalize, but even when children engage in, you know, serious, you know, violent offenses that we have learned how to be, to take a rehabilitative response, to be graceful and corrective when we're dealing with white children who've committed serious crime. But we tend to dehumanize Black children by prosecuting them as adults and imposing severe sentences that treat them as if they're beyond redemption.
Can you share with us some of the adversities you personally went through during the writing, editing, research process that went into this book? How did you grow from the challenges involved in bringing a book from idea to publication? Can you share anything autobiographical about the writing, researching, and editing process, what it says about you, and how you overcame those difficulties?
Yeah. So it's interesting to think about it as adversities, because I write an entire book about adversities that my clients and other Black and brown youth have experienced. But yes, there were many challenges that I, you know, experienced. I mean, right, you know, I could think of, you know, several things. One is I'm a law professor, right? I'm a lawyer and an academic, and we are trained to write a certain way. We write with legalese and big words. And I really wanted to write a book that would be accessible to a mainstream audience, right? And that would change hearts and minds of everyone. And so I wanted to write a book that could be read by the teenagers who are impacted themselves, a book that could be read by lawmakers, teachers, judges, prosecutors, as well as just, you know, an everyday person, a neighbor, a community leader. And so I struggled with that. I'll be honest with you, Ari. I wrote the book and I would have our drafts of various chapters and I would share them with friends. And my friends would say, you know, I think you could, you know, rewrite this section a little bit. So I learned a lot. I grew a lot in writing this book and writing in a way that would engage with all of society, what was my hope. And I did that by telling stories and then weaving those stories together with research and data, but research and data told in plain language. And so that was one thing that I learned. Another challenge that I experienced was that, I tell a lot of stories in the book. And so I had to revisit those stories, right? Revisit stories about my clients. So I might pull up old police reports about some of my clients. And I really found myself in distress. It was painful to revisit that. And it made me realize, wow, if this is just this painful for me, in retrospect, going back, I felt like I was experiencing some level of secondary trauma, if you will. And I kept thinking to myself, wow, how painful and traumatic must this have been for my clients at that time and with their families? And so it just was, it renewed some of that empathy and understanding that I had for my clients in that way. So that was a second thing. A third challenge I think that I faced was really I had a strong desire to preserve the integrity of the voices of my clients and of some of these high profile cases that I write about, Tamir Rice, Mike Brown, Jeremiah Harvey. And so I wanted to honor their voices. I didn't want to impose my narrative on those stories. And so I lost a lot of sleep about making sure I did that well. But with regard to those high profile cases, I spent a lot of time going back, listening to videos, watching interviews of the parents of the children who had been killed due to police violence or vigilante violence around race, precisely because I wanted to reflect their voices and not just my voices, my assumptions about how they were feeling and experiencing the loss of their parents. And then the final challenge I experienced in writing this book was, as you know, Ari, this book is in some ways biographical. It is hard to be a Black American and not have some contact, personal contact with the criminal legal system in some way or another. So I found that writing this book was bringing up for me some of my own personal family experiences with the legal system. My brother, who was in the system, who spent, a great deal of time in prison. And so I never went into this book thinking that I would write about that. But as I told those stories, it became impossible, not to tell those stories. And so, it was a challenge, but it was part of the healing process as well.
You alluded to your brother, and your brother indeed shows up in the book. Can you share with us some details about your brother, what he went through, what he experienced, and how his experience impacted you and your family?
Yeah, definitely. This appears, appears a little bit sporadically throughout the book, but it's most heavily, I believe, in chapter 11, the chapter I call The Black Family in the Era of Mass Incarceration. And that chapter for me was definitely the most painful chapter to write. I cried quite a bit and, had to put it down several times. And I have another brother that I write about a little bit, but not in the same way, that I had to share that chapter with so that, I could be comfortable sharing our family story, publicly in this book. And so, as I said earlier, it's impossible really to grow up Black in America and not have some at least direct or indirect ties with the criminal legal system. And my family is no different. So my family was incarcerated for many years before he died, and he ultimately died in prison. And he had a double aneurysm in prison. And so there were several things I think that I was grappling with as I was writing the book. It's one, sort of trying to wrap my head around how is it on some level that he got involved in the criminal legal system, and how he came to be arrested, and how he did indeed commit, engage in some criminal behavior. We can never really answer that question. How do people get involved in criminal behavior? But one of the things that I do know is that my, brother was a typical teenager, and we grew up in a middle-class family, educated, household. And he was a typical teenager who did typical adolescent, impulsive, reactive things that were prompted by, him wanting to fit in with his friends in the neighborhood or, in nearby neighborhoods. And so, like other kids, he experimented with drugs and, did some things that, that he wouldn't be proud of, or, even stealing. And what I concluded, at least as it relates to this book, was that although he was engaged in those typical adolescent behaviors that other kids, also of other races engage in, that police, or the system targeted him. There's no room for grace and tolerance of those adolescent indiscretions. One of the things that I say in the book is that maybe there was ultimately nothing wrong with him, but that society treated him as if something were wrong with him, as if he were somehow uniquely deviant. as compared to other teenagers. And I write about that a lot in the book, the ways Black children are treated as deviant for normal adolescent behaviors. So that was one aspect of what I write about. The other aspect, and I think this is the most painful aspect, and that I talk about in chapter 11, was that he, spent, time in prison, an extended period of time in prison, and how painful that was as a sibling, to really just be disconnected from your family in that way when he was there. And when I was in college and law school, I wrote to my brother because, especially in law school, when I began visiting prisons as a young lawyer or aspiring lawyer, and just realizing how, terrible those facilities are. And I wanted, him to know that there was someone out there who cared about him. There's inadequate healthcare, and he had diabetes. And so he ultimately had an aneurysm in prison and, wasn't able to eat right. The culinary practices of the facilities are not geared towards somebody who is diabetic. And so really he, his fate was severe, right? It was actually life-taking, not just, we think about what does it mean to incarcerate them, to hold them accountable. But we're incarcerating people in facilities that are really draconian and dehumanizing and actually more harmful than they are helpful in terms of advancing public safety.
In light of your brother's story, I'd be curious to ask you about other forms of abuse that take place in prison. What kinds of cruelty have Black youths suffered in jail at the hands of fellow inmates and corrections staff? And along these lines, you tell the story of Khalif in your book. Can you talk about Khalif in light of the suffering and cruelty that take place in jails?
Absolutely. And so, Khalif Browder was a 16-year-old boy who was arrested for robbery of a book bag, right? Someone else's book bag. And what was so extraordinarily tragic, and this was in New York, Bronx, New York, what was so extraordinarily traumatic about Khalif's story is that it is extremely, extremely likely that Khalif was completely innocent and never even took the book bag at all. But even without us knowing specifically whether he was guilty or not guilty, the facts are that the complaining witness, the victim in that case, left the country within weeks of that robbery. In other words, he moved back home to his home country and never returned. So the impact of this is profound, that the prosecutors who, okay, so the police officers arrest him, they charge him with robbery, they put him in jail, and specifically they put him on the notorious Rikers Island. And he stayed on Rikers Island for 3 years, wow, waiting for his trial date. Well, the significance of the fact that the complaining witness moved out of the country and was never coming back is huge. So the prosecutors at some point knew they had no victim and that he would not return. Despite, calls and efforts to get him back, he did not come back. So here's the tragedy. You've got a 16-year-old child in Rikers Island. And although I should note, Rikers Island is known as an adult facility, and he was tried as an adult, he was held on a youth block with other young people. But I have to tell you that few environments pose a greater risk to healthy adolescent development than the toxic and isolating a setting of an adult prison or jail. We seem to forget that when we prosecute treat children as adults, that they're still children. They are particularly dangerous places for teenagers. Young people face verbal and psychological intimidation. They are the frequent victims of physical attacks by both inmates and staff. Staff do very little to prevent inmate-on-inmate violence in those facilities. And sometimes the staff even participate. Kalief Browder in particular, there are videos of him being literally beaten by staff in Rikers Island. Even when staff aren't engaged in that type of physical abuse, other young people are the target of shackling, excessive restraints like shackling and restraint chairs that keep children strapped in position for extended periods of time.
Gosh.
Yes. I mean, it's just, it's tragic. Children face, you know, psychological trauma through unmerited discipline, extended periods of isolation, which they call solitary confinement. They're taunted, they're bullied. Young people are particularly at risk for sexual abuse. You know, adult inmates and staff take advantage of a young person's size and powerlessness. And so, you know, and even when there are federal laws, right, that protect young people from sexual abuse, the laws are routinely violated when young people and adults are commingled in spaces together. And so, you know, I got to say that even when a young person is not the direct victim of physical or psychological, or victim of physical or sexual abuse, they also experience the trauma of just watching their other young people in the facility getting victimized, right? And so it's just, it's really, really traumatic. And so Kalief Browder, like I said, spent 3 years in jail. Everybody should be just devastated by that fact, waiting for his trial that never, ever, ever happened. Everyone is responsible for that. The prosecutors who didn't dismiss the case, the judges who didn't insist upon a speedy trial or dismissal, everybody who had their hands in this is at fault. So ultimately, Kalief Browder gets out after 3 years. The judge finally ordered his release, the prosecutor finally dismissed the case, but he was so psychologically traumatized by his 3 years in jail that he took his own life. And that's what's, you know, Kalief Browder really, it was known for. He actually hung himself out of his mother's, home, a bedroom window upstairs in his mother's home, because he had endured such an extended period of trauma.
Oh my goodness. Thank you for sharing that. Another connection with respect to your brother and his situation is the omnipresent theme in your book about the impact that incarceration has on siblings of the imprisoned. You point out in the book, stigma, shame, and isolation are recurring themes in many families with incarcerated children. Some even pretend their sibling died or never existed. Many youth discover they have become the target of police scrutiny as a result of their sibling's arrest. Police in the family's neighborhood assumes that the child must be destined for a life of crime because this is what your family does. Can you share more about the impact on siblings of having a brother or sister incarcerated?
Yes. So Ari, you know, that's another good question, because there have been books, entire books written on the impact of parental incarceration on children. There have been very little writings on the impact of policing and incarceration on siblings. And so I began to take that on a little bit in this book. And, you know, I reflected on how my clients that I represented had experiences that were very similar to my own experience of having a brother in the system. And so many of my clients had siblings who were impacted, or clients themselves had older siblings who they had seen, you know, and felt that pain and agony. So what happens to a sibling? I mean, I would say siblings cycle through a range of emotions, right? Concerns about their sibling's safety. Once they learn that a child, one of their siblings, a brother or a sister, has been arrested or detained, incarcerated, they experience sadness at the loss of a friend and a companion, many of whom, you know, they share a room with at home. You know, they experience anxiety about having to visit a brother or a sister in jail or prison, and just imagine what that experience is like.
Yeah.
Going into, yeah, you know, prisons and jails and being pat down and strip searched in order to visit with a sibling. They experience shame and embarrassment about having a sibling in the system, right? So like I, you know, you just read from that quote. So you might pretend like you never had a sibling so that you're not embarrassed. And this notion of being targeted and labeled and presumed to be criminal just because you had an older sibling, or, you know, a sibling of the same age who has been arrested before. So you're now living with the not only additional stigma and embarrassment, but you're also living with the additional stigma. I mean, excuse me, the additional intrusion on your life, additional stops and frisks by the police, you know, being interviewed, interrogated by police officers because you have a sibling in the system. You know, there's also a little bit of, you know, of resentment, you know, and guilt, because you feel resentment about having a sibling who's now been arrested and has disrupted the whole family life. And so, you know, young people talk about having nightmares and reliving vivid images of seeing their brother and sister handcuffed, beaten, or hauled away, you know, by a police car. And what's really tragic is that parents can rarely tell a child how long their sibling will be gone, especially in the early stages of a case. And so a child's anxiety may continue to be unresolved for extended periods of time. And so, I mean, those are just some of the emotions that are associated with having a sibling in the system. And we don't really talk about that much.
Can you comment on the story of Dejeria? Mm-hmm. Who is Dejeria? And can you tell us about him and the episode that you narrate in the book about him?
Well, so Dejeria Becton is actually a girl who I think this is really a good story to talk about, because it brings in the ways in which girls experience, Black girls in particular, experience the same sort of criminalization, the ways in which normal adolescent behaviors get demonized. And so Dejeria Becton was a Black girl from Texas, who had a birthday party, to be quite frank. She was from McKinney, Texas, and she lived in a private neighborhood, which was a predominantly white subdivision of Dallas. And it was sort of an end of the year party, birthday celebration. And she invited friends from her school. And one thing that this story tells us is the ways in which, this goes back to my point about policing by proxy, the ways in which civilians don't want, you know, or don't want Black children around, or are afraid of Black children. And so they had this public not a public, but they had a private pool within this private subdivision in which Digeria lived in, right? And other children had had parties in that pool. But when Digeria showed up, there were a disproportionate number of Black children who also began to show up for this party, and white residents made comments about how they didn't belong there and they couldn't use the party or the pool in that way. And lo and behold, they called the police. And so the second theme that arises from this story is the ways that the police officers raced in, made assumptions about these Black children who were at this party, made assumptions that they did not belong there, that none of them were residents when that wasn't true at all. And then also the physical response. One of the officers approaches this 15-year-old girl, Digeria Becton, with a baton, and he yells at her to get on the ground. And he begins to grab her wrist and drags her on the ground in her bikini. And wrestling her arms behind her back while she is screaming and crying and begging for him to stop. And so it was just such a tragic response to, again, a normal adolescent function, a birthday party, right? Instead of thinking about alternative ways to respond to and address the conflict between neighbors by, you know, approaching and asking the young people, you know, if they live there, and trying to mediate a conversation instead of automatically making assumptions. And even one of the white students, there were some white children who were invited to the party, commented in news interviews about how differently that Black children were being treated. Essentially, all the Black children were being arrested and ordered to sit on the ground and placed in handcuffs, where all the white kids were told to just go home. And so that story is a great example of so many of the themes that I explore in this book.
In what ways do females in Black and Brown communities experience the trauma associated with policing differently than males?
So, you know, I go out of my way in this book to incorporate girls into the entire conversation. Instead of, you know, people, when I was writing the book, people would say, hey, are you going to have a separate chapter on girls? And I said, no, I want folks to see how incredibly intertwined that trauma is. And so your question is you know, is a sharp one. One, Black girls are subject to the same historical stereotypes that criminalize them. Georgetown Law School, right here where I am, Georgetown's Law School's Center on Poverty and Inequality did a qualitative survey of adults and their perceptions of girls, and found that adults tend to view Black girls as less innocent, more adult-like than white girls. They perceive Black girls to behave older than their stated age, to be more knowledgeable about adult topics, including sex, and to be more likely to take on adult roles and responsibilities. And this all helps explain why Black girls faced more severe and more frequent types of discipline in school, greater use of force by school resource officers, and harsher penalties in the juvenile legal systems. And so the stress, I talk about how Black girls who are criminalized in this ways are sent to detention and subject to those types of abuses that I just talked about: restraints, strip searches, loss of privacy, emotional isolation. All of this during the most important years of their lives, these adolescent development years. And so Black girls experience the same kinds of stress and trauma as Black males, not only from individual stops by the police and frisks and arrests and force, but also from watching their siblings and partners and fathers and uncles being stripped from their communities and sometimes even killed. They lose the companionship and intimacy of Black male partners. They lose income from you know, again, Black males that are ripped from their homes, who previously provided support, and you know, they're often overlooked in this conversation about the need for police reform. And so I think about girls, women, for example, like Sandra Bland and Breonna Taylor and Tatiana Jefferson are some of the most visible examples of Black girls who suffer from, you know, the trauma and some of the need for reform in policing in America.
Can you tell us the stories of Naya and Shakara? What happened to them, and can you elaborate?
Sure. So, you know, some people will remember this story. This is the story of Shakira Murphy was the teenager in the Spring Valley, South Carolina high school, who was purportedly playing on her cell phone or looking at her cell phone during math class. And a teacher comes over and asks her, you know, to put it away. And she was slow to do so. And so the teacher called in the principal or called in, you know, either the vice principal or the assistant principal, who instead of coming himself sends in a deputy sheriff. And so the deputy sheriff comes into the classroom and literally rips Shakira Murphy out of her seat, flipping the seat backwards in front of the entire class. And this video went viral, and it really shed light on the physical abuses that we see, and of course not all, but we see among a school police officers. And people, you know, were outraged and just thought it was such an unnecessary use of force and abuse. And Naya Kinney is the girl who was in that classroom who recorded the video. And here's what's so significant. Both of those girls got arrested, and both were charged, for example, with a statute called disturbing schools. Yet another example. Isn't that wild, Ari? Wow. You know, but it's yet another example of the criminalization of normal adolescent behaviors, right? Things that all kids do. And so they said that her Shakira playing on her phone and Naya recording the incident disturbed the whole class, when the reality is nobody was disturbed until that deputy sheriff came into that room and ripped her out of the seat. What we learned later is that this was a math class and all the students were taking a test. Nobody was paying attention to Shakira. And what we also learned very recently, long after this incident, was that Shakira was a special education student and that she had been instructed by her one-on-one aide that if she ever had problems or difficulty with one of her assignments, that she should reach out to her one-on-one aide. So she was using her cell phone to get in touch with or to text that aide so that the aide could come down and help her. But nobody wanted to listen to her. And instead, they took a traditional law enforcement response to a typical adolescent behavior. And she was actually doing exactly what she had been instructed to do. But there was violence and policing when we didn't need it.
Another story, if you feel comfortable sharing, is that of Eunice Fennell. What lessons can be learned from her tragedy?
Yeah, so another one of the stories that I tell in the book is about Niecy. And I tell Niecy's story really similarly to the story I tell about Kalief Browder, to talk about the ways in which incarcerating children with adults is one of the absolute worst things that we can do. And so Niecy Fennell was a teenager from originally, actually, she was from Southern California, but she moved out to Durham, North Carolina. And she, you know, had a traumatic childhood. Her father was addicted to drugs. Her father was abusive. And Niecy's mother ultimately moved Niecy and her twin brother to Durham, North Carolina, to get away from that abusive situation. And when she was in Durham, Niecy, you know, made friends, new neighborhood. She's 16 years old, and she meets these guys, unfortunately, who get involved in a shooting. And Niecy at the time was driving the car, and Niecy and her family and friends insist that she had no idea that there was going to be a shooting or was in no way involved with the shooting. But the local prosecutors really wanted her to be a witness against these boys. And so they arrested her. They charged her with being an accomplice to this homicide, and they put her in jail. And they put her in jail with adults, right? And she's in this tiny pod with adult inmates, female adult women inmates. Wow. Who abused her. Yes. They, because she was from Southern California, they, you know, took advantage of that and, you know, said that she was involved with gangs when she wasn't. And so there was violence, verbal threat, bullying. She was taunted also by the staff at the facility. And she cried often, you know, and she confided in multiple people, including her lawyer. She confided in another adult in the facility that she was thinking about taking her own life. And, you know, the facility never, the jail, the adult jail, never got her the type of mental health services that she needed while she was there. At some point, while she was incarcerated, her twin brother was shot and killed.
Oh my goodness, it was awful.
I mean, it's just, you know, tragedy upon tragedy. And again, remember, she was a witness, right? The prosecutors were charging her as an accomplice, but even they, you know, did so with the understanding that she wasn't the shooter. It wasn't clear to them how much she knew, but she refused to snitch because she was afraid, right? And so she ultimately, while in prison, unlike Khalif, who took his life after he got out of jail, Niecy Fennell took her life. She committed suicide, hung herself in the facility. So I share that story. I mean, so, you know, we've talked, Ari, about a lot of really tragic examples, you know, and I hope, you know, readers will still, you know, read this book and recognize, you know, the importance and the relevance of the stories. But this story was relevant and important for how all Black teenagers are disproportionately treated, how we should have had a rehabilitative response to Niecy Fennell instead of locking her up, putting her, you know, in solitary confinement, you know, at various times, and subjecting her to abuse, all of these things. So there's so many lessons to learn from that story.
If we place this problem in historical context, I was wondering if you could comment on the case of George Stinney and its relevance.
Yeah. So George Stinney is the youngest person ever executed in 20th century America. And so he was 14 years old. He was a 14-year-old Black child, right, in 1944 in South Carolina. And so I, just as you noted, I bring in this story as a historical backdrop, because what I want to show in the book is that America has had a long history of failing to treat Black children as children, and that, you know, the execution, right? Execution of children is considered to be barbaric all over the world. And the United States of America was one of the last three countries in the world to ban or prohibit the execution of a person who committed a crime when they were the age of 14. But George Stinney's story is not only about that, the execution, the disproportionate execution of Black and Brown people in our country, but like the dehumanization of a 14-year-old. I don't care what a 14-year-old did, that we would ever think that it would be appropriate to execute them. Well, of course, as was true in so many of those early cases of, and even some of the contemporary cases, but early cases involving the execution of Black youth, George Denny, by all accounts, in subsequent review, is very likely innocent. So he gets executed for something that he didn't do. And in particular, he was accused of brutally murdering two young girls by beating them over the head with a metal spike and dumping them in a muddy ditch. The reason why I wanted to tell you that is because George Stinney, I told you, was 14 years old. These girls were white girls, and people wanted to believe that it had to be someone Black and that it had to be a Black male, given all of the stereotypes and assumptions about the sexuality and the hypersexualization of Black youth. And so the narrative that was put forth was that this 14-year-old raped one of the girls, beat the two girls, and threw them in a ditch. I mean, and by all accounts now, everybody knows it just wasn't even physically possible that he could have done such a thing, right? He was a skinny little kid, didn't have the strength to do it. He was forced to, his entire trial lasted 2.5 hours with 6 witnesses, no transcript. There was a confession that he said he confessed, the police officer said he confessed to the crime when there was absolutely no written record whatsoever. And there was also no evidence whatsoever that either one of the girls had even been sexually assaulted. So my point here is this narrative of fear that has permeated Black youth from the founding of American society. You know, we demonize Black youth in order to justify slavery, in order to justify the lynching of someone like Emmett Till, to justify the super predator myth that was put forth in the 1990s. And all of these incidents were ultimately, you know, disproven. Even, you know, it's known now that Emmett Till didn't even whistle, you know, or flirt with this white woman. I mean, she later recanted. And then this super predator myth demonizing Black children in the 1990s was recanted by, you know, John DiUlio, the Princeton professor who made this narrative up, or had this pseudoscientific theory. And he recanted it himself. But those narratives intentionally put forth now live on in the American psyche and calls all of us to fear Black children and lead to this overcriminalization of Black kids. So I wanted to bring in George Stinney's story into the narrative just to provide that historical racial through line of the criminalization of Blackness and the criminalization of Black adolescents in particular from the founding of American society.
What do you recommend in regard to school reform to address some of these problems? There's a quote in your book where you write, "We have the tools we need to build healthy students, successful learners, and safe schools. Now we just need to treat Black children as if they belong. Remember that we don't need police to save our schools." What suggestions do you recommend in regard to school reform, in regard to what your book is detailing?
Yes, we, you know, as a society have really bought into this idea that law enforcement is the only way to ensure community safety and the only way to ensure school safety. And the evidence just speaks to the contrary. It really does. And that we are actually doing more harm than good, particularly in relying on police officers to correct, redirect, discipline, or even raise, if you will, raise children. And so what I recommend is and what the research supports is a public health approach to both community safety and school safety. And so that means a health-based approach that is attentive to the relationships, cultivating healthy, nurturing relationships between children and adults. a strategy that is trauma-informed, that acknowledges and recognizing the traumatic effects of over-policing and hyper-surveillance on adolescent development, and that is attentive to the ways in which adolescent traumas or traumas that adolescents have experienced in their lives contributed to criminal behaviors. So it needs to be trauma-informed. It also needs to be restorative. A strategy for community safety and school safety needs to restore or repair relationships that have been breached. And it needs to be racially equitable. So what is that look like in practical language on the ground? It means that a public health approach to school safety will have a continuum of mental health providers for young people. It will have social emotional learning as a part of the curriculum, which is all about teaching young people how to engage with one another with empathy, compassion, respect. We need vocational opportunities, positive behavior interventions, restorative justice modules. And, you know, even in schools where there is some evidence of real violence, a lot of the traditional law enforcement strategies are imposed in schools where there isn't any demonstrated evidence of real violence. But in those schools where violence does exist, we need credible messengers and violence interrupters who've been demonstrated or are proven to be effective in engaging with at-risk youth.
Can you comment on the suffering experienced by the parents of those who are accused, arrested, and incarcerated? In what ways have they deteriorated emotionally and psychologically while their children have been imprisoned? What kinds of support, if any, is available to them? How do they cope?
So, I mentioned earlier when you asked about challenges that I experienced in writing this book, that I really wanted to go out of my way to honor the voices of the parents and not speculate. I looked at interviews by, you know, Khalif Browder's mother and Samaria Rice, who was Tamir Rice's mother, and, Mike Brown's mother and father. And what we see is that, it's the trauma is just so profound. Parents talk about nightmares that they have with, even seeing their child in shackles, never really being able to celebrate holidays anymore, really being devastated on birthdays, just the sense of agony at the loss and just the ways in which so many of those deaths and violence are rooted in racial discrimination, and how many of those incidents involved Black children who were killed for something that they didn't do. Tamir Rice didn't have a real gun, or just Khalif Browder, committing suicide after being held in prison for 3 years for something that he did not do. And I really want to be clear that this book is not just about innocent children, right? But the fact that we would put even children who do commit crimes in adult facilities is devastating for parents and devastating for families, particularly because they recognize unequivocally, they recognize that white children would not be treated the same way. And so there's a layer of that pain and that agony and that loss that we are grappling with. You also asked, though, about what help and what support is available for parents. And so many of the parents, in fact, almost every single parent that I write about in this book, in these high profile cases, became an activist and an activist around police reform and reform of the juvenile and criminal legal system. And, Khalif Browder's mother, Vernita Browder, really was a very vocal spokesperson about the need for reform of solitary confinement confinement, for example. And in New York City, you know, solitary confinement is now prohibited for young people. And people attribute it, some of those gains and some of the successes in reform to Vernita Browder's advocacy. New York City also had a successful Raise the Age campaign, which reduced or which made it such that children under the age of 18 should not be tried in adult court. So things of that nature have come about as a result of youth, parental activism. Samaria Rice started an entire foundation. Number of the parents have started foundations. And so I would say there's agony and there's hope, right? There's agony and there's resilience among Black parents. And so that would be really a powerful, powerful takeaway that everyone should have from this book.
Thank you. As we bring this interview to a close, what are you working on next as your current project? What are you working on now as your subsequent research?
So more than anything, Ari, I am trying to convert the sort of the written text into action.
Okay.
The reform, the strategies that I propose in chapter 12 for reform and some of the things that I talked about with school-based reform, I want to convert that into action. And so we've got a number of projects or in my office. So one, me personally, I do a number of trainings and across the country for state actors, judges, prosecutors, defenders, probation officers, folks who are engaged in the juvenile criminal legal system, also with school systems, right? Teachers and school administrators, trying to educate them around some of these issues, right? Some of the research that I personally did not know, notwithstanding the fact that I've been working with children for 26 years. So I'm doing some of that. I also partner with my office, the Georgetown Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative. We partner with the Gault Center, which was formerly known as the National Juvenile Defender Center. And we do a number of initiatives to address these issues. We have an Ambassadors for Racial Justice program. We have a racial justice toolkit that we make available for youth defenders across the country. So, you know, I still, you know, am writing and researching, but more than anything, I'm trying to spend my time converting these stories, these narratives, and this research and these strategies for reform into action.
I wish you the best of luck with these righteous endeavors. They're so important, and I could not agree more with you about the importance and necessity of these initiatives. And I cannot thank you enough both for what you're doing after you've written this book and your current initiatives, and for everything you sacrifice to bring this book into fruition for us.
Great. Well, thank you, Ari, for having me. I really, you know, like I said at the top of the hour, I really appreciate what you're doing and creating a platform for, you know, all of us in society to address these issues and to listen. So thank you.
Thank you. I absolutely appreciate your time with us today. I'm blessed by how much I learned from you. And thank you on behalf of all our listeners to everything they will undoubtedly take away from your words of wisdom and the insights and stories you've shared with us.
Thank you.
As we bring this interview to a close, I am your host, Ari Barbalat, on the New Books in African American Studies podcast. I have been in dialogue today with Chris Henning. Chris is Bloom Professor of Law and Director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic and Initiative at Georgetown University Law School. We have been discussing her new book, The Rage of Innocence, How America Criminalizes Black Youth, published in New York by Pantheon Books, 2021. Thank you very much.
Thank you.